Good afternoon, everybody. Apologize for the delay in getting started today. I do not have any announcements at the top, so we can go straight to your questions. If you're ready, Darlene.
I am, thank you. Do you have any details for us on the power outage and how broadly the White House may have been affected by it?
I suspect that might have been the subject of some conversation back here. I can tell you that there was a power outage this afternoon that did briefly have an impact on the White House complex. Some parts of the White House complex did have to go on to backup power, but some of the issues have been addressed in such a way that we're now back on the regular power source. So things are slowly but surely returning to normal here in the White House complex.
And is there anything you can say about what the president was doing or where he may have been when the power dipped?
I am not under the impression that the president was in any way affected by this. I happened to be in a meeting with him, and when I walked out of that meeting, I was informed that there had been a power outage. So at least during the period in which it seemed to be most noticeable, I was with the president, and he did not notice.
Nothing
so,
where you were?
Not that I could perceive.
On Iran, I was wondering if you had any reaction to Speaker Boehner saying today that the framework deal with Iran is a direct threat to peace and security in the Middle East and around the world, and that it would pave the way for a future nuclear-armed Iran. And he's responding to some comments the president made in the interview yesterday with NPR.
Well, Darlene, one thing I would point out is that that is not the conclusion of the government of Saudi Arabia or the government of Egypt, both of which have put out statements supportive of the diplomatic agreement that was announced at the end of last week. And both of those governments, who are located in the Middle East, suspect that this is the kind of diplomatic agreement that would actually bring some greater stability to a very volatile region of the world. We're pleased to see their encouraging statements. We've also been direct in acknowledging that there are more details that need to be negotiated with the Iranians. That's why these negotiations on the more technical aspects of the agreement will restart, and we anticipate that, or at least hope, that an agreement on all those details would be reached by the end of June.
So you're saying that Speaker Boehner should wait a little bit, wait for the details?
I'm saying that I guess what I would suggest is that every member of Congress should wait until June 30th before fully evaluating the wisdom of this agreement. Now, they certainly can draw on the kinds of commitments that Iran has already made in the context of this initial step here. And those commitments are significant. Those commitments do effectively block every pathway that Iran has to a nuclear weapon. And those commitments do include Iran cooperating with the most intrusive set of inspections that have ever been imposed on a country's nuclear program. That represents progress toward our goal of preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, and that's why the president described this effective piece of diplomacy as our best bet for preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
One last question having to do with the NPR interview. The president took a dig at Scott Walker and said that he needed to bone up on his foreign policy, and then last month, the president also criticized Scott Walker when he signed the right to work bill into law in his state. So I'm just wondering, what does the president have against Scott Walker?
Well, I'll just say that I assure you that there is that's nothing personal. Both of them, as you know, participated in the Gridiron Club dinner last month. But there's no doubt, as I'm sure that even Governor Walker himself would be happy to tell you, that there are some significant policy differences between the two men, and there will be ample opportunity over the course of the next year and a half for us to discuss those differences at some length, I suspect. But I'm not going to start that today.
Okay. Jeff.
Josh, back on the power outage, can you talk at all about what led to this, both at the White House and then across D.C.?
The proximate cause of the disruption in power is something that I think PEPCO is looking into right now. That's the local utility, and so they're taking a look at this. I do understand that my colleagues over at the Department of Homeland Security have indicated that they do not currently see a nexus to terrorism or anything like that. But this is something that PEPCO is looking into, and I'm sure as they get more details about the cause of this disruption that they'll be able to share that with you.
Can you confirm that DHS is investigating this as well?
I don't know if there's any investigation that's going on their part. I know that anytime something like this occurs, they're certainly aware of it and interested in understanding what exactly happened. I don't know if there's any sort of formal investigation going on, though.
And what happens at the White House when there's a power outage? You said you went briefly on backup power. Is that generators?
In terms of the infrastructure that's involved, I don't have an answer for that. What I can tell you is that the impact on those of us who are working at the White House was minimal. And that there were at least some of us who were unaware of any sort of impact or event when it first occurred. But, you know, for obvious reasons, a complex like the White House has certain built-in redundancies to mitigate the impact of these sorts of events. And at least as it relates to this specific situation, those redundancies proved to be effective.
Okay. And moving on to a couple other questions. The humanitarian crisis in Yemen, it's expanding. To what extent is that not only on your radar, but what else can be, what can the U.S. and what is the U.S. Trying to do about it?
Well, first and foremost, Jeff, what we believe should be done in Yemen is that all sides to that conflict should participate in a UN-led process to bring an end to the violence and try to negotiate a political settlement to the conflict. And right now, I would concede that that seems something that's unlikely to happen in the near term. But that should not be used as an excuse for anybody to resist the efforts of the international community to try to bring an end to the violence, to try to negotiate a political resolution to the crisis, principally because of the terrible impact it is having on hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in that chaotic region of the world. And the United States has put our full weight behind that UN-led effort. At the same time, we are certainly understanding of the steps that the Saudis have taken to try to resolve the security situation along their southern border. Their concerns are justified, and the United States is providing some logistical support so they can take those steps. But we would like to see us get to the point where all sides who are involved in this conflict would enter into a UN-led process to try to resolve diplomatically the conflict in that country.
But can you speak to the fact that Yemen imports 90% of its food, and so more and more people are going hungry? Is there anything that the U.S. is doing to address that particular humanitarian part of the conflict?
Well, I don't have any announcements to make at this point, but this is obviously the human impact of this violence is something that we're mindful of and extremely concerned about, and we'll be closely monitoring the situation in the days and weeks ahead. Okay, JC.
How does this administration feel about the latest request from the Saudis of the Pakistani military to help assist them with the crisis going on in Yemen?
Well, we know that there are a number of countries that have pledged support to the Saudis, and one of the countries that the Saudis made a request of was the United States. And because of our close security relationship with Saudi Arabia, the United States is using some of our unique capabilities to support this ongoing mission that, again, is dedicated to addressing legitimate security concerns that they have along their border with Yemen. I know that there are a number of other countries that have pledged to support the Saudis in this effort. That's obviously a decision that those countries are making, and one that many are doing at the specific request of the Saudis. Okay.
Justin?
First, I wanted to sort out something from the president's interview with NPR yesterday. He said one concern about the deal that people might have that he saw as kind of legitimate was that in maybe 11, 12, 13 years, that the breakout time would be reduced from a year to a far shorter period. And then over the State Department before the power went out over there in the middle of Maria's briefing, she seemed to be trying to clean that up and saying that was an incorrect reading of it. So could you clarify that for us, what the president envisions in year 11, 12, 13 of if that year-long breakout period would remain?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say a couple of things. What we indicated in the fact sheet that was released at the end of last week is that the breakout period for Iran would extend at least 10 years. And that obviously is a dramatic improvement over the current situation. Right now, our experts estimate that Iran is essentially has a breakout window of 2 to 3 months. And again, this breakout window is if Iran were to make a decision to pursue a nuclear weapon, the amount of time it would take for them to build up a stash of weapons-grade material to build a weapon would take 2 to 3 months. And again, we envision a scenario where that is essentially quadrupled or quintupled, depending on how you measure it, over the course of the next decade. After that, there are still some details that need to be negotiated in terms of what the breakout period looks like. But what is also true after that 10-year window is that we have extensive insight into Iran's nuclear program, and we have greater ability to understand exactly what they're up to, so that we can more closely monitor their activity and have a more precise understanding of exactly what that breakout period would look like.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is if I'm Iran, right, and my goals are maybe both sanctions relief and getting a nuclear weapon, it seems like a pretty great deal to get a decade of sanctions relief while I can build up all of my nuclear infrastructure that I need to do, build these advanced centrifuges that we don't yet have, and then at the 10-year mark have a breakout period that's essentially zero. So even though the U.S. figures it out, we can flip the switch and start again.
Well, but don't misunderstand that there are significant limitations that are placed on their nuclear program in the first 10 years. So it would not be accurate to say that Iran would be enhancing their capacity over 10 years when it comes to their nuclear program. In fact, they're rolling back many key aspects of their nuclear program. Everything from significantly reducing their stockpile of uranium from 10,000 kilos to just 300, so basically reducing that stockpile by 97% or more. They are obviously reducing the number of centrifuges that they have by two-thirds. They're making specific commitments about the level at which they'll enrich uranium. Iran has agreed not to enrich uranium over 3.67% for 15 years. So we're talking about long-term commitments that Iran is making to scale back their nuclear program and to ensure that their nuclear program only exists for peaceful purposes. And the other thing is that Iran has agreed to cooperate with intrusive inspections so we can both verify their compliance with the agreement, but also have a greater understanding of the scope of their nuclear program, so that after 10 years we would actually have a much better sense about what their goals are and what capabilities they actually have.
About was Chuck Schumer and Politico yesterday, I think while we were in this briefing maybe, kind of came out publicly and said that he would endorse the Corker legislation. It looks like Democrats are now, or Democrats and Republicans are a vote away from a veto-proof majority on that. Is the incoming Senate majority, or Democratic leader in the Senate, publicly backing this bill that you guys have really kind of forcefully come out again, a sign that your strategy is not working? And at what point do you sort of shift strategies from saying, we don't want this at all, to let's try to alter this bill in a way that might be a better solution for you guys?
Well, the first thing I would say about that is that the administration continues to be in close touch with members of Congress about this agreement. And it continues to be our position that members of Congress should evaluate this agreement on the merits. And if they review the four-page parameters document that outlines the long list of commitments that Iran has made to block every pathway they have to a nuclear weapon, it should strengthen everyone's confidence in this ongoing diplomatic effort. At the same time, I will readily acknowledge that there are additional details that need to be locked down, and that will be the substance of ongoing negotiations through the end of June. That's why we've been very clear from the beginning that Congress, if a deal was reached by March, that Congress should not take a vote that would undermine negotiations until any time before June 30th at a minimum. And that continues to be our position. Now, the other thing that I will tell you is that there actually is, that there are a number of concerns that we have with the Corker legislation. And let me try to be more specific than I was able to be yesterday in highlighting one area of concern that we have. And that is specifically included in the Corker legislation is a provision that essentially makes the agreement contingent upon Iran renouncing terrorism. Now, that's an unrealistic suggestion, because we've been very clear that this agreement is focused on preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, and that it is not going to succeed in resolving the long list of concerns that we have with Iran's behavior. We know that Iran has for decades menaced Israel and made anti-Semitic claims about its people. Those are threats that we consistently and continue to roundly condemn. That's true before the agreement, and that will likely be true after the agreement. The president alluded to that in the NPR interview that he did yesterday. We've raised concerns about the unjust detention of Americans inside of Iran. The release of those American citizens is not contingent on the completion of the deal. That doesn't mean that we're not interested in seeing those Americans released. We certainly believe that those Americans should be released. The point is, we want to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. And inserting a provision like this that essentially is intended to undermine the agreement in the first place is why we so strongly oppose, or at least have significant concerns and oppose, the current form of the Corker bill. Okay? Ed, go ahead.
Josh, if the president is making this big sales pitch that you've been touting, doing these interviews, and the incoming top Democrat, as was just noted, says, I'm not buying it, I'm going to support this bill that the president says don't support. Doesn't that suggest the sales pitch is falling flat?
No, Ed, the sales pitch has only just begun, and that's because we continue to be in a position where we want to make sure that members of Congress actually understand what's included in this agreement and to understand what significant commitments we obtain from the Iranians when it comes to scaling back their nuclear program. That's one reason why we have offered up to members of Congress who serve on the National Security Committees that they can get a classified briefing from Wendy Sherman. So she's one of the primary negotiators of this agreement. We're offering up a classified briefing to members of the National Security Committees in Congress about the agreement, because we want to make sure that people consider this agreement on the merits. And if they do so, they will understand the wisdom of this principled diplomatic approach.
Right, but I'm saying you're offering that classified briefing. We're going to give you more info. Wait until the end of June. And Chuck Schumer, one of your allies, saying, no, I'm not waiting. How can you say the sales pitch is working?
I'm saying that the sales pitch is just beginning, and that there's ample reason why individuals who take a close look at this agreement can conclude that this is clearly the best way for us preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. That's what the Saudis believe. That's what the Egyptians believe. That's what a former Mossad chief said in an op-ed that ran an Israeli newspaper yesterday. So there is strong evidence, and there are a lot of experts, both technical and otherwise, who have reviewed this agreement and have reached the same conclusion that the president had, that this is the best way for us to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
The president called the current Senate Democrat leader, Harry Reid, last week. Does he have a commitment, the president, that Harry Reid will vote no on Corker Menendez?
Well, for his position, you should check with Senator Reid. But we continue to strongly believe that there are Democrats who are interested in this kind of principled approach to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. But those conversations continue, and for individual members of Congress who have a position on this issue, I'll let them state it.
No, you would think you'd have.
No doubt about it.
Okay. In the NPR interview, I just want to follow up on Justin. The president said, quote, we're purchasing for 13 to 14, 15 years, assurances the breakout is at least a year. And then he goes on, and then in years 13 and 14, it is possible that those breakout times would have been much shorter, but at that point, we have much better ideas about what it is that their program involves. We have much more insight because of this deal into their nuclear capabilities, he's saying. Doesn't that suggest breakout is a year in terms of them getting the capability to have nuclear weapons for the first 13 years? But the president's acknowledging in years 13, 14, 15, they may have the capability to get them much quicker.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, Ed, what is no doubt true is that right now they can get it much more quickly. Right now, our experts tell us that the breakout window is 2 to 3 years. And that's the wisdom of this agreement, is that if we can, over the course of more than a decade, get greater insight into Iran's nuclear program and succeed in blocking every pathway they have to a nuclear weapon?
Pardon me, 2 to 3 months, isn't it?
I'm sorry, yes. Did I say 2 to 3 years?
Yes. I just want to be clear.
I apologize. What our experts tell us is that currently the breakout period is 2 to 3 months. And under this agreement, we could extend that period to a year for more than a decade. And that is the commitment that we've received from Iran, and that certainly is preferable to the current scenario.
Just two other quick things. At the Easter prayer breakfast today, the president said sometimes he hears, quote, less than loving expressions by Christians. He gets concerned about that, but he said that's a topic for another day. Do you know what he's referring to, what he gets upset about?
I don't.
Okay. Last thing, Bo Bergdahl. There's some new information suggesting that he showed an intent to travel to Uzbekistan, did multiple searches on his computer about organized crime, made contact with a local Afghan to try and get off his military base sooner. Are you concerned about these allegations? Have you heard about them? Does it change your mind at all about the idea that he served with honor and distinction?
Ed, I'm very reluctant to weigh in on this, and it's because there are sensitive issues related to the chain of command and the military code of justice. So there's an ongoing investigation by the Army into this specific matter. So I'm very reluctant, as the spokesperson for the Commander-in-Chief, to weigh in on this matter. What I will tell you, though, is that the President's commitment to ensuring that any service member will not be left behind is a value that we continue to firmly believe in, and it's one that this President believes is important for him to uphold and for all Commanders-in-Chief to uphold.
But if you don't want to jump ahead of the investigation, we've talked about this before, why did Susan Rice go out there and say he did serve with honor and distinction when you didn't have those facts?
Well, Ed, I don't want to comment on the case that's still under investigation by the Army. Okay. Mark?
Josh, when you said you were with the President at the time of the power outage, what room were you in? Were you in the Oval?
Yes, Mark, we were in the Oval.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of windows there, so you might not have noticed.
That's true. That's why I said that we did not perceive any sort of change.
Did other offices in the West Wing experience power outages?